Hi, Fawos Universal Time. Stay tuned for Daybreak Africa coming up after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Victor Beatty reporting. Airline blames external factors for Saturday's passenger jet crash. Russian transport officials are analyzing data from the flight recorders recovered from the ill-fated Metrojet A321, which crashed shortly after takeoff from Sharm el-Sheikh, Egypt, en route to St. Petersburg, Russia. All 224 on board were killed. AirSafe's Todd Curtis says answers to the mysterious crash should be forthcoming within days.
It's unclear whether or not there's useful data on there yet, but I'm sure within a few days, at least that amount of information will be presented to the public. There is quite a bit of information from the wreckage itself that has yet to be analyzed in any great detail, either by the Egyptian authorities, the Airbus authorities, or the Russian authorities. So I believe that there is ample technological prowess being brought to bear in this particular situation.
The airline Monday cited external reasons for the crash after ruling out technical failure or human error, but the Russian Air Ministry called that premature. Both Moscow and Cairo have played down claims from Egypt's Islamic State branch it downed the plane. Sectarian violence broke out anew in the capital of Central African Republic weeks before a planned visit by Pope Francis. Armed assailants reportedly killed several people and set scores of homes ablaze in Bangui, the violence centering around the PK5 Muslim neighborhood. Bangui resident Melanie Anjokra says no one provides answers as to why people are dying and for what cause. Interim President Catherine Samba-Panza called for the intervention by the UN peacekeeping force. The Vatican Monday indicated the Pope's trip to the country, racked by 2 years of sectarian violence, is still on for November 28 and 29. This is VOA News. President Obama, during a televised interview Monday, said the U.S., by sending dozens of special forces into Syria, does not represent another U.S. intervention in the Middle East.
We have run special ops already, and really this is just an extension of what we are continuing to do. We are not putting U.S. troops on the front lines fighting firefights with ISIL. But I've been consistent throughout that we are not going to be fighting like we did in Iraq with battalions and occupations. That doesn't solve the problem.
Mr. Obama appearing on the NBC Nightly News broadcast, a White House national security official, said Monday U.S. forces will not be fighting side by side with forces inside Syria. He said they're intended to be a force multiplier, allowing those on the front lines to better their efforts to take back territory from the IS group, but he said U.S. troops, quote, may have to engage the enemy. Four Israelis were stabbed in separate attacks Monday, including a 70-year-old man who was seriously wounded in the northern coastal city of Netanya. His 22-year-old Palestinian assailant was shot and killed. The attack came hours after another Palestinian knifed several people, including an 80-year-old woman near Tel Aviv. 11 Israelis and 69 Palestinians have died in more than a month of violence. The UN says more than 218,000 migrants crossed the Mediterranean Sea during the month of October, more than the total amount of migrants that crossed all of last year. Adrian Edwards is with the UN Refugee Agency, UNHCR.
So it's an enormous number of people. It's producing enormous pressures on places where people are arriving, the Greek islands in particular, seeing particular strain. On the 20th of October, we had more than 10,000 people in a single day on these arriving on islands where there simply hasn't been the capacity to deal with those kind of figures. So a really overwhelming situation.
Edwards says if conditions don't change, the level of arrivals in 2016 will continue. Iraq's parliament has voted to limit the powers of the country's prime minister in passing reforms, forcing him to seek approval by lawmakers for enacting new measures. The decision comes just months after lawmakers unanimously voted to approve Mr. Abadi's reform plan aimed at reducing government spending and tackling corruption. The Democratic Republic of Congo Monday said more than 70 children adopted by foreign couples can now leave the country after being held up for 2 years. Congo's justice minister made the announcement after meeting with ambassadors from several of the countries where the would-be parents reside. The government moratorium on the adoption process followed allegations some of the children were abused, subjected to traffickers, or adopted by homosexual parents, which is banned under Congolese law. I'm Victor Beatty, VOA News.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Barte in Washington. Today is Tuesday, November 3rd, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Some candidates are being officially nominated today for Uganda's 2016 presidential election, even as the opposition failed to agree on a joint candidate.
The coalition of the other many, about nine political formations, decided to continue with Right Honorable Amama Mbabazi as a presidential candidate, and our colleagues in the Forum for Democratic Change decided to go it alone.
The Honorable Mena Seguna is a member of parliament and a supporter of former Prime Minister Amama Mbabazi. Political tensions are rising in Zimbabwe between ZANU-PF and the opposition MDC supporters and a new rebel group in South Sudan's Western Equatorial State.
There are names of officers and former MPs that are leading this rebellion or vigilante. I'm sure that is more than vigilante group that the bishop is referring to.
Colonel Philip Aguo is the spokesman for South Sudan's army. Russians and Egyptians are mourning the victims of Saturday's plane crash in Egypt. A self-disseminating vaccine could help stop infectious diseases in West Africa. And demand rises in the U.S. for an ancient Ethiopian grain. Those stories, plus Mark Oldman's post and our listener of the day, are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Today is nomination of presidential candidates for Uganda's 2016 general elections. President Yoweri Museveni, who has ruled Uganda for 30 years, will be nominated by the ruling National Resistance Movement for another term. Also being nominated today for president is former Prime Minister Amama Mbabazi, who is running as an independent under the auspices of the Democratic Alliance. Tomorrow, Wednesday, longtime opposition leader Chisa Besigye will be nominated by his Forum for Democratic Change, the FDC. Dr. Besigye and Mbabazi failed to agree to field a single candidate despite last-minute marathon meetings. The Honorable Meda Seguna is a member of parliament and a supporter of former Prime Minister Mbabazi. He said the two sides had irreconcilable views on which candidate should represent the opposition.
Well, I must confess there was no agreement reached. We failed to agree. We had conceded to a number of proposals. Unfortunately, our colleagues from the FDC felt that it would be right for them to field a presidential candidate. And we have no problem with that. It's their right. So we did not reach an agreement. The coalition of the other many, about nine political formations, decided to continue with Right Honorable Amama Mbabazi as a presidential candidate. And our colleagues in the Forum for Democratic Change decided to go it alone.
Can you tell me, sir, why did the two candidates not agree? Can you give me one or two reasons why?
Well, I could give more, but I want to be more precise. And in summary, it was a disagreement as to who would be the flag bearer, who would be the presidential candidate. We had offered to concede the prime ministership and the first deputy premiership to the FDC. But in turn, their view was that they should take the presidency. So I think it rotated on that. We felt that we have the best candidate. They felt they have the best candidate. And that's the fundamental reason why, I suppose, the talks failed in that direction.
Why do you think Mr. Mbabazi feels that he should be the presidential nominee?
Well, this one is building from the processes earlier started by the Democratic Alliance, a formation to which all our opposition political parties did agree to form and have a joint presidential candidate. And in that, the rest of the political formations, the parties, agreed that Right Honorable Mbabazi would possibly be a better candidate than the FDC candidate. The FDC candidate was supported by one political party, while the rest supported Right Honorable Amama Mbabazi. So we think that the criteria adopted by the Democratic Alliance at that time still remains, and nothing has fundamentally changed, because it was a question of majority versus minority.
And when you talk about majority, minority, what I understand is that one of the sticky points is that the Forum for Democratic Change, Dr. Besigye's team, was asking or has been asking, say, the Honorable Mbabazi to show how much support can he bring say he's the nominee of the opposition, how much support can he bring to the table? Can you tell us the level of Mr. Mbabazi's support?
Nobody can tell about the level of support unless the campaigns have begun. But one thing I can give you assurance about is that he comes with a wealth of experience, knowledge of the inside operations within the NRM. He's been prime minister in this country. He's been secretary general of the NRM. But the more fundamental thing I can say is you could look at the record when he ventured to go out to Mbale, Teso and Sorotian Jinja. You would see the amount of support. Otherwise, before elections, you cannot be talking about how much support somebody has, because it would be based on imagination and speculation.
The Honorable Medar Segona is a member of parliament and supporter of former Prime Minister Amama Mbabazi. You are speaking with me from the Ugandan capital, Kampala. The spokesman for South Sudan's army says rebels loyal to former Vice President Riek Machar are responsible for the insecurity in Western Equatoria State. Colonel Philip Aguo is calling on community leaders in three towns to work with the government and identify those who are attacking government troops in Western Equatoria State.
What is clear in Western Equatoria, there are names of officers and former MPs that are leading this rebellion or vigilante, including somebody called Wesley Waluba, including a recent officer called Kabila, who defected from Maridi, and many other names that are known in the area, including the sons of former governor of Central Equatoria, who was a captain in the security. He left the national security and joined that vigilante group. So I'm sure that is more than vigilante group that the bishop is referring to.
Community members from Mundri, Louis, Jambu that I have been in touch with, they are saying that there is no rebellion in the area, but rather some elements of the SPLA have gone on rampage, looting and destroying properties of civilians. Could you tell us which battalion is in charge of that area and why are they attacking civilians?
I'm afraid you are not talking to the wrong people. Mundri has been occupied partially by a group, and this group have been attacking SPLA position in the garrisons of Mundri. Now, how do these vigilantes attack SPLA garrisons and ambushing SPLA convoy and patrolling?
The bishops came from there and said the situation is very bad, that people are starving, they cannot attend to their farms because they are too scared to go out, because your soldiers are all over the area, arresting people indiscriminately, not even identifying them.
I agree the situation is bad. Innocent civilians have been displaced from their homes, but that is because there is an armed group that has been attacking the government soldiers that have been ambushing, and soldiers are trying to look for these bandits. And I believe it's not the normal civilian that are making this road unsafe.
The civilians are too afraid to come closer to your army.
Because the towns are being attacked by this vigilante group that the bishop is referring to. This vigilante group is attacking towns. And if the civilians are caught in between, it's better for them to move away from the town. And then when the situation calms down, the civil authority together with the security authority sit down in Mundri, in Maridi, and identify the threat. Where is the threat to the security of the civil population? And I believe the army will collaborate.
Let's move away to Upper Nile. There is a gentleman calling himself General Johannes, who is leading a new group called Tiger Faction New Forces. They are fighting in Upper Nile. Do you know about this gentleman?
Yes, Johannes Okit is a Major General that was with the SPLA forces in Weta Corner up to 28th of last month when he defected and joined forces of Riek Machar. The SPLA is in full control of the area. There is no new movement. These are all under Riek Machar.
That was South Sudan Army spokesman Colonel Philip Aguo speaking from Juba, South Sudan, with John Tanza of VOA South Sudan in Focus program. Today is Tuesday, November 3rd, and you're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Please send your comments and opinions to daybreakafrica@voanews.com. Daybreak Africa time is coming up at 15 minutes past the hour. tensions continue to rise between supporters of Zimbabwe's two main political parties, the ruling ZANU-PF and the opposition movement for democratic change, MDC, of former Prime Minister Morgan Tsvangirai. This came after violence erupted over the weekend when supporters of both parties tried to use the same venue for their political meetings. MDC spokesman Ober Gutu says his party was given a green light by the police to hold a provincial rally in the area, but were surprised to find ZANU-PF supporters already gathered at the same venue, triggering running battles.
I can actually confirm that sitting over to today, Monday, the 2nd of November 2015, there are running battles where ZANU-PF thugs armed with stones, sticks, machetes, and all sorts of assorted weapons are still attacking our supporters within the Hopley area of Harare South constituency. And I actually have information that about seven of our supporters were actually seriously hurt, and they are still detained at a private hospital in Harare. And what is surprising us is that this is just a typical ZANU-PF, following upon Grace Mugabe's utterances a few weeks ago in Mandarin, where he said that no opposition party should be allowed in areas where ZANU-PF thinks they are dominant. And obviously, as the MDC, we would like to voice our deepest regret and concern at the deteriorating security situation.
Have you reported this to the police?
Definitely, the matter has been reported to the police. As usual, we have been reporting these matters where our supporters are victimized, beaten up. We have been reporting ever since the formation of the party. We are very well documented. But what we have always wondered is that the police don't seem to have any appetite of apprehending the ZANU-PF culprits.
That was Movement for Democratic Change spokesman Ober Gutu in Harare speaking with reporter Jonga Kandimiri of VOA's Zimbabwe service. According to a report published this week in the medical publication, expert review of disseminating vaccines could potentially be used on animal populations in places such as West and Central Africa to help stop infectious diseases before they spread to human populations. Dr. Michael Jarvis, senior author of the report, tells Ricky Stryak about these types of vaccines, which, when developed, could use virus-based vectors that allow some animals to become carriers of the vaccine and then spread it among other members of their species.
You're trying to target a gorilla and to vaccinate them against Ebola in the darkest of the tropics. And how do you get access to them? You can't go up and physically vaccinate every animal as you would have to using a conventional vaccine. So this, using disseminating vaccines, which I should stress are in the very early stage of development, are a potential means by which we can solve that problem to enable us to vaccinate large numbers of defined populations of wildlife.
How does it work as opposed to a normal vaccine?
So our approach is to take advantage of evolution. So the virus that we're using is called cytomegalovirus, and it's a herpes virus that induces large immune responses in both the humans and the animals that it infects. But it's got other attributes or characteristics that make it suited for use as a disseminating vaccine. One is that it's extremely species specific. So humans have their own form of CMV, gorillas have their own form, mice have their own form. So, and the different four or species specific CMVs that can't infect the other animals. So with that, you actually, that has to address concerns about, well, if you put out this disseminated vaccine, is it then going to spread to all other species? CMV, by its nature, has evolved not to be able to spread into other species. So for example, if we're wanting to target and vaccinate gorillas, we'd use a gorilla CMV that would then isolate from the gorillas, we'd then engineer in a region of Ebola that would provide protective immunity, and then we would give it back to the gorillas. So essentially, you're taking a virus that they already have that generally doesn't cause any disease. You then put in a region of Ebola that would then provide protective immunity to them, and you give them back the virus. That's the whole idea. It's actually interesting from an important, not just from the human health aspect, but also from the animal conservation aspect, specifically in terms of Ebola. So Ebola, we've seen the effect that can have on humans, but also has as great an effect on gorilla, chimpanzee populations in the wild. It was, I think there was an estimate that it has reduced gorilla populations by about 30%.
Are these self-disseminating vaccines being tried out and used anywhere?
So the purpose of the review was really to establish sort of the framework from where we are right now. So they're all the approaches using the dissemination approach are very much their early developmental stages. So we're not going to see anything that would be feasibly for the next, we're probably looking, you know, 6 or 7 years. But the purpose is also is to raise awareness that this is an approach that has certain advantages over other approaches.
That was Dr. Michael Jarvis, a molecular virologist at Plymouth University. He was speaking to Ricky Stryak from Plymouth, England. As the bodies of the victims of a Russian airliner that crashed in Egypt on Saturday are returned home to Russia, some Egyptians are also mourning the 224 victims. Viewer's Heather Murdoch attended a lit Sunday vigil in Cairo.
During the weekend, the bodies of 140 victims of the Russian airliner crash in Sinai were transported to Cairo and then to St. Petersburg for identification. On Sunday, Russia recognized a day of mourning. In Cairo, Egyptians laid flowers outside the Russian embassy, and some young people gathered to express their condolences.
We are delivering a message from the voices of the Egyptian youth to the Russian people that we give them our sincerest condolences, and God willing, the country will be able to provide justice for those people who died.
Officials from the Russian airline say the plane was in good condition and the crew was not at fault.
The only possible explanation for a breakup of the aircraft in the air could be a certain impact, some mechanical or physical impact.
He does not say what that impact could have been. Militants in Sinai claim to have downed the plane, but some experts say the Islamic State affiliates do not have the weapons. The plane broke apart in the air about 20 minutes after taking off from the Sinai resort, Sharm el-Sheikh. Egyptian officials warn it may be months before the real cause of the crash is discovered. Heather Murdoch, VOA News, Cairo.
Lots of cultures around the world have a staple grain that's little known or little grown outside its home region. Three examples: teff from the Horn of Africa, kiwa from South America, and amaranth, the grain that fed the Aztecs in Central America. A lot of these grains are now showing up on North American grocery shelves and are gaining popularity. Correspondent Tom Bansi tracked down some early adopters who invited this wave.
Wayne Carlson became a convert to Ethiopia's staple grain while doing public health work in Africa in the mid-1970s. The tiny grain is called teff. It has a mild, nutty, or earthy taste.
I came to know teff because I was eating it all the time and hosted by teff farmers.
Teff flour is the key ingredient for the signature spongy flatbread found in Ethiopian restaurants. In the late 70s, Carlson returned to the U.S., married, and settled in southwest Idaho. Then he hatched the idea to introduce teff grass to North America in his home state.
Geologically, it's very similar to Ethiopia. Ethiopia is placed on the East African Rift Valley, which is very much like the Snake River Plain.
Neither Wayne nor his wife Elizabeth are farmers, nor do they want to be. So they convinced actual farmers in Idaho, Oregon, and Nevada to grow teff on contract for them, and they mill it. Until last year, though, there wasn't a single Ethiopian restaurant or bakery in the entire state of Idaho to sell the milled flour to.
The way we started was Wayne went through the Washington, D.C. telephone book and looked for the names that were Ethiopian.
And that's how the business slowly grew for several decades, serving the far-flung Ethiopian and Eritrean immigrant community in the U.S. The teff company has outgrown four different mills. The first was a little stone grinder in the Carlson's basement. They currently occupy a remodeled brewery complex in Nampa, Idaho. The Carlsons say the teff flour coming off this packing line now could well land in an upscale natural food store or commercial bakery. According to an industry trade group, Sales of alternatives to modern wheat are growing at double-digit rates each year. Teff production in the U.S. exploded over the past decade, says Oregon State University research agronomist Rich Roseberg. It's gone from 1,200 hectares in 2003 to more than 40,000 nationally by 2010. Roseberg says the majority of the teff grown in Washington State, Oregon, and back east is destined for livestock forage.
It's a good livestock forage in general, but it does seem like horses have a preference for it in some informal taste tests where we've compared teff with other common grasses.
In Idaho, however, where the Carlsons are based, Roseberg figures more of the teff production as grain for human food. Teff contains lots of nutritious calcium, iron, protein, and fiber. Roseberg credits Wayne Carlson for being ahead of his time.
So he recognized the value of teff, at least for teff grain, long before any of the rest of us did.
The University of Nevada, Reno, is leading a project to breed improved varieties of teff. The aim is to make it more productive and drought-tolerant in anticipation of harsher growing conditions due to global warming. For VOA News, I'm Tom Bonsi in Nampa, Idaho.
Time now for Daybreak Africa Sports, and here is Mark Owoma in Johannesburg, South Africa. Very good Tuesday morning to you, Mark.
Good morning, James. In our Daybreak Africa Sports News, we begin with athletics. Ivory Coast's Marie-José Talou and the Republic of Congo's Frank Elembe were named the best female and best male athlete at the 2015 All-Africa Games. The Association of National Olympic Committees of Africa, ANOCA, disclosed at the General Assembly in Washington, D.C. in the United States of America over the weekend. Talou set a women's 100-meter championship record of 11.02 seconds. She later won the 200-meter gold medal and bronze medal in the 4x100-meter relay. Elembe established a championship record of 20.25 meters in men's shot put. He also bagged a bronze medal in discus. In football, Cameroon pipped hosts Republic of Congo 1-0 in Brazzaville. In the return leg of their African Nations Championship qualifier on Saturday, Cameroon win their tie 1-0 on aggregate and qualify for the Nations Championships due in Rwanda in next January. Cameroon's triumph is a significant boost for newly appointed coach Alexander Belinga and his assistant John Kemp Bonaventure, appointed to replace German tactician Falk Finkel a day before Cameroon's departure for the Brazzaville encounter. In hockey, hosts and defending champions South Africa retained the men's and women's crowns at the Africa Hockey Championship played in Randburg on Sunday. In a repeat of events 2 years ago, South Africa downed Egypt 4-2 in the men's final as Kenya pipped Ghana 4-3 in the bronze medal playoff. The women's event was a round-robin affair, with South Africa beating Ghana 3-0 in the decider to win the contest. Although Nigeria beat Kenya 3-1, Kenya snatched the bronze medal ahead of Nigeria. Finally, in handball, Egypt's Zamalek beat Tunisian defending champions Club Africains 35-22 to win the men's contest at the Africa Handball Club Championships in Nador, Morocco on Saturday. Egypt's Sporting Alexandria pipped Tunisia's Esperance 24-23 to claim the bronze medal. The women's final, an all-Angolan showdown, was a repeat of last year, with defending champions Primero de Agosto edging Petro Atletico 23-21 to retain their crown. And that's it for Daybreak Africa Sports News. I'm Mark Ouma in Johannesburg, South Africa. Back to you, James, in Washington.
Thank you, Mark. Have a good day. Briefly, before we leave you, a summary of Africa news. Somali militants from the Islamist extremist group Al-Shabaab have ambushed the government soldiers south of the Somali capital, killing more than a dozen military personnel. Al-Shabaab put the death toll from Monday's attack at 30, while a Somali military official says at least 15 government soldiers were killed. Al-Shabaab militants say they also seized several military trucks in the ambush, which took place nearly 100 kilometers south of the capital, Mogadishu. That is it for this Tuesday, November 3rd edition of Daybreak Africa. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Clotty and Ricky Stryak, and our engineer Jamie Cook, I'm James Butte in Washington saying have a lovely day.
Next on Straight Talk Africa, we'll explore the secrets of doing business in Africa from an American corporate executive's perspective. Join host Shaka Sali and his guests as they share how U.S. companies can best play catch up with the fastest growing continent. That's next Wednesday at 18:30 UTC on VOA Africa.
African music mix.
Everyone is looking for something special when maybe they should just listen instead. The VOA's African Music Mix will soothe your nerves and calm your head. Tune in from 0 to 300 UTC and 1100 to 1300 hours UTC to make you feel good. So treat yourself to that something special.
VOAAfrica.com.
News, features, music from Africa and around the world. You want it? We have it on VOAAfrica.com.
VOAAfrica.com.
All day, all night.